Hello there. Today is Monday, March 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the investigation into what caused an Ethiopian plane to crash, killing everyone on board.
There has to be a thorough investigation by the FAA and the NTSB as to whether these planes are safe, because there are just too many coincidences.
President Trump's political strategy going into the next presidential election. The battle for the last ISIS stronghold in Syria is now underway. Also ahead on this day in music history, it's all on today's International Edition. People from more than 30 nations were killed in a plane crash in Ethiopia early Sunday, including 8 Americans. Kenya and Ethiopia lost the highest number of nationals. Officials are investigating what caused the Boeing 737 MAX 8 en route from Addis Ababa to Nairobi, Kenya, to crash shortly after takeoff. All 157 people on board died in the crash near the town of Bishoftu. The same model aircraft crashed in October in Indonesia. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The new list from Ethiopian officials show 35 nationalities among the dead after the plane crashed shortly after takeoff. In all, 157 people were on board. 5 Germans were killed and 3 each from Russia, Austria and Sweden. Spain, Israel, Morocco and Poland each lost 2 citizens. Countries losing one of their nationals include Belgium, Ireland, Norway, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, Serbia and Nigeria. The stricken plane was carrying people set to attend a major United Nations Environment Conference in Nairobi. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Ahmed Khalid's father had received no news from his son, who was meant to be on board that fatal plane. Traveling from Dubai, Ahmed was due to change planes in Addis Ababa and continue en route to Nairobi, but a delay in Dubai caused him to miss flight ET-302, and he had to wait for another connection. He learned about the crash when he was on board his plane to Nairobi.
Everyone was asking the cabin crews what is happening. But no one was saying anything. They were just going up and down until one of the passengers saw on his mobile the first plane which just flew. 6 minutes after flew, it just crashed.
The U.S. National Transportation Safety Board and Boeing are sending teams to the crash site to help with the investigation. And joining us to talk about it more is aviation safety expert Captain John Cox, a veteran pilot with extensive involvement in global air safety. So this isn't the first time this type of jet has crashed. I know it's probably premature, but do you have any sense of what may have happened?
It's very early, and we don't have all the data that we need. So to draw conclusions between this accident and the tragedy in October last year of Lion Air, it's a bit premature to do that. And the investigators are going to look very carefully at that, but we can't draw any conclusions or non-conclusions one way or the other at this stage. We need to find the recorders because they will tell us the story.
My understanding, though, is that this particular type of plane has had problems. The Boeing 737 MAX 8, same type of plane as you just mentioned with the Lion Air jet. Will they obviously be looking at there could be a correlation here?
The investigators have got everything on the table. They will look very methodically at this airplane, but also at the fleet history. And the information so far is that the airplane had flown normally and did not have any mechanical defects, and it had flown up from Johannesburg, South Africa, into Ethiopia previously, and the airplane was fine. That's the report so far, which is dramatically different than the Lion Air airplane that had been having mechanical issues for 4 days before their accident. So these are some of the differences that the investigators are going to have to go through very carefully, very methodically, to see if, in fact, there's any commonality.
Do you think there's a chance that they will discontinue using these particular planes in the meantime?
I would say that at this point, there is no justification for any thought of grounding the MAX, because we don't have enough information yet. And the investigators work on evidence. And if there's evidence of a problem, they will bring it to light, and that will become then the regulatory agencies such as the FAA the investigative agencies such as the National Transportation Safety Board and the manufacturer, they will get together and determine what is the best course of action. But we're not there by any stretch of the imagination yet.
If a plane takes off and everything seems normal and then all of a sudden it goes down soon after taking off like this, would you say it's safe to say it was some sort of catastrophic event while in the air, or is that also something that would be speculation at this point?
It would be a bit speculative. One thing we do know is that the crew advised air traffic control that they had a problem and they wanted to return. And so something in the airplane is abnormal or non-normal. And so the captain made the decision that they wanted to return back to their home airport. This says that they're going to be very busy with checklist and with diagnosing the problems. And this is why the recorders are going to be so critical, to be able to tell not only the digital flight data recorder to provide what occurred, but also how the crew was handling it, which will be on the cockpit voice recorder.
Do most plane crashes occur either shortly after takeoff or before landing?
The very few accidents that we do have break down into different phases of flight, with landing having the highest number, approach having the second highest number, takeoff having the third highest, and climb having the fourth highest.
Obviously, we probably won't know anything for quite a while, I would assume.
I would expect that they will find the recorders pretty quickly. They know where the airplane is. It's in a lot of small pieces, but they will, I think, fairly quickly be able to locate the recorders and get them to a place that can read them. Washington, D.C., for the National Transportation Safety Board. Everybody recognizes that this is a very high visibility accident. So as soon as they find the recorders, they're going to take immediate steps to get them read out. Then we'll have a pretty good idea of what happened.
All right. Captain John Cox, a veteran pilot with extensive involvement in global air safety. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The Russians rally against moves to tighten control of the internet. Activists appear unveiled in Tehran on Women's Day. Islamic State attacks gathering of Afghan leaders. And Bouteflika returns to Algeria amid protests. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. It's 20 months until the next presidential election, but U.S. President Donald Trump has already found a battle cry. He's betting his anti-socialist stance will box rival Democrats into a corner and pave the road to another victory in 2020. White House correspondent Patty Witakuswara examines whether anti-socialism is an effective re-election strategy for today's America, where many are disillusioned by what they see as the failures of capitalism.
No more private property. No more you.
It's been more than 60 years since the era of Cold War propaganda cartoons, but socialism may still be the boogeyman of American politics.
The state will do your planning from now on.
At least for President Trump.
Socialism is about only one thing. It's called power for the ruling class.
With 20 months until the election, anti-socialism is Trump's battle cry. At the annual Conservative Political Action Conference earlier this month, the president accused Democrats of wanting to replace individual rights with total government domination. His main target? A self-proclaimed Democratic socialist and one of the front-runners in the crowded Democratic primary field.
An economy and a government which works for all of us, not just the 1%.
Sanders champions policies such as universal health care, free higher education, and doubling the minimum wage. He also backs the Green New Deal, a non-binding resolution proposed by Democrats to revitalize the economy and eliminate carbon emissions.
The Depression have brought poverty and hunger.
The term harkens back to President Roosevelt's New Deal, a massive government stimulus to restore prosperity during the 1930s Great Depression. But is Sanders the best candidate to unite the non-Trump voters?
If the Democrats nominate some far left-wing candidate who talks about socialism, that is the best outcome for Republican candidates and for President Trump to be reelected.
Polls show American views on socialism have evolved, particularly those of millennials who came of age during the 2008 recession and are disillusioned about an economy that is delivering fewer opportunities.
They're very wary of spending beyond their means. They're wary of tools like credit cards.
But it's a bet the president apparently is willing to take. Analysts point out that painting Democrats as socialists will reinforce Trump's base and expand Republican appeal to Hispanic voters.
Absolutely, in a place like Florida, where there's a large number of Venezuelans and Cuban immigrants, they understand exactly what socialism is and they hate it.
Which is exactly what Trump emphasized in his Miami speech last month.
Socialism promises a better future, but it always returns to the darkest chapters of the past.
A warning the president is likely to repeat on his way to 2020. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Clashes and fierce fighting are being reported in northeastern Syria, where U.S.-backed forces say their final assault on the Islamic State terror group enclave of Baghouz is underway. A spokesman for the Syrian Democratic Forces made the announcement on social media Sunday. Officials with both the SDF and the United States are expecting a difficult battle. They say IS has been using a network of tunnels, caves, and trenches to hide and launch counterattacks. They describe the tunnel system as complex, extending possibly for more than 2 kilometers and rigged with explosives and booby traps. There are also questions about how many IS fighters are left to defend the last shred of the terror group's self-declared caliphate. But as more than 20,000 civilians and fighters have emerged from the area to surrender over the past week, they've been forced to reassess their estimates. Officials now say it is possible that thousands of IS fighters are still there, prepared to fight to the death. The White House said Sunday it is not under any illusions about whether North Korea is preparing to resume missile testing, but refused to assess commercial satellite imagery suggesting Pyongyang is assembling a new rocket. National Security Advisor John Bolton told ABC News that the U.S. watches North Korea constantly.
Well, as the president said, he'd be pretty disappointed if Kim Jong-un went ahead and did something like that. The president said repeatedly that he feels the absence of nuclear tests, the absence of ballistic missile launches is a positive sign. And he's used that really as part of his effort to persuade Kim Jong-un that he has to go for what the president called the big deal, complete denuclearization.
Imagery seems to show North Korean missile activity at an assembly operation. Those commercial satellite photos were taken 3 days ahead of the summit meeting between Trump and Kim. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talked about that with Stephen Norper, Senior Director for Policy and Education at the Korea Society.
Well, certainly the U.S. government has a very high capability, given its satellite imagery, to know in almost real time what's happening in North Korea. And President Trump made it clear that there's a full knowledge of where North Korea is with its development and the locations. And so I think we need to take it in a bit of a cautious light, and that's that there may have been activity, but we shouldn't necessarily equate that with an imminent missile launch or satellite launch. It's clear if it's Sohae and reactivated, they may well have been exercising a negotiating ploy, either with the anticipation that the Americans would see activity and know that going into Hanoi, or in the aftermath that it would show the serious nature for the U.S. calls for checks against missile and nuclear development. It's hard to say whether it's actual preparation for a satellite launch or meant to be a negotiation tactic.
There has been some speculation that this could be not a missile, but a rocket launch, the difference being that they might want to launch a satellite or something that doesn't seem as possibly warlike than others. Have you heard that, and what do you think about that?
Well, I have heard that, and I think it's important to remember that we know they have the thrust capability already from their continental ballistic missile test of November of 2017 and in July earlier that year. It's different because things like guidance systems and miniaturization, things that would concern one about a missile test, don't apply on a space launch. What it also says is that the U.S. and international community should be thinking, if the North Koreans are looking for an internal legitimizer like a space launch, that there may be ways to have China, Russia, Kazakhstan provide for a launch for North Korea that then mitigates or lessens the U.S. and international community concern about trying to perfect that technology for missile launches.
How much damage, if any, has been done to either side, the U.S. or North Korea, by the failure of the summit meeting?
Well, I think we need to realize that these things take a great deal of time, and denuclearization is a complex process. So I don't think we should write it off as a complete or abject failure at this point. I think there was a walk away from negotiation 2 hours prior to its ending, and there's a process at play, and it's an unusual one because it's a top-led process, meaning that there hasn't been a lot of preparatory work done. It means that they need to get back to the table for a second or third round of negotiations. Beyond that, this may have just been part A of B or part A of ABC. There may be an agreement in the offing. It did seem that when they came into it, the North Koreans were willing to give up their Yongbyon nuclear facility, perhaps in its entirety, and they've already done a testing moratorium and until now have had a downtick at the Sohae missile site. So it looks like there has been a perceived progress on their part. There are no missile flying, as the Trump administration has said. And it seemed like the administration was ready to give partial sanctions relief. It's a matter of getting those to match, the U.S. giving partial sanctions relief or some sort of partial declaration and verification regimen.
Do you think North Korea will ever give up its entire nuclear capability?
It's very hard to say. It's their only negotiating card. They find themselves, from their definition, strategically disadvantaged. They say they need a deterrent, and they say that it provides a level of legitimacy. But maybe Kim Jong-un is willing to trade that off for economic modernization, and that seems to be what the U.S. administration is pushing for, that there are real tangible economic results if they do trade that off, that security is not in maintaining nuclear weapons, but in giving that up.
All right. Well, asked about the satellite images Friday, Trump said he would be very disappointed if North Korea resumed nuclear testing. Sunday marked the start of Sunshine Week, which highlights the role of freedom of information. During Sunshine Week, major U.S. news organizations worked together to showcase journalism's role in promoting transparency in government. Organizers say the main goals for the week is to educate people on what it means to have an open government and why it's important. This year, the focus is on the loss of local news coverage and its impact on communities. The Associated Press says new data shows that more than 1,400 cities in the U.S. have lost a newspaper in the past 15 years. And a new HBO documentary called Breslin and Hamill, Deadline Artists, is based on the lives and careers of two famed newspaper columnists named Jimmy Breslin and Pete Hamill. It also highlights the demise of local journalism, particularly newspapers. The film is studded with important cultural figures like Spike Lee, Shirley MacLaine, and Gloria Steinem. I caught up with one of the directors, Jonathan Alter. So, Jonathan, this is so timely given that to some degree, journalism has become the story. Tell us about these two reporters and why they were such giants of journalism.
Jimmy Breslin and Pete Hamill were larger-than-life tribunes of working-class people. They both came out of the working class themselves. They didn't go to college, began working in newspapers when they were young, and came up the hard way, you know, with a lot of challenges in their lives. Nick Pileggi, who wrote Goodfellas, says in our film, I mean, you could go to Oxford for 4,000 years and not know how to cover the streets the way a Jimmy Breslin does. So, you know, part of what they represent that we've lost that connection to the streets. So they both represented that, but they also both spoke truth to power, and there was an accountability there that they were providing. They were doing it in a way that was not just fun and compelling, but often brilliantly written on Deadline. Mm-hmm. And they had very different styles. You know, Breslin was more rat-tat-tat, like Hemingway, short sentences, whereas Hamill was a poet. So they were good friends, sometimes rivals, sometimes at the same paper.
Of course, newspapers are becoming a bygone era. This was the height of print journalism, whereas now we've really shifted dramatically. Newspapers have gone out of business, and it really was a different style and a different way of communicating.
Right. We aren't trying to do a nostalgia trip here, but we want to tell viewers of HBO that there was a time when giants roamed the earth. Print journalists were giants in the culture. It's almost unimaginable now that a print journalist like Jimmy Breslin could host Saturday Night Live. That's how big he was. That a print journalist like Pete Hamill could date the most famous woman in the world, Jacqueline Onassis, and Shirley MacLaine, the actress, at the same time. You know, a print journalist did this. They have no standing in the world, but their literary qualities, the fact they were, as we call them, deadline artists, they could do beautiful work on a very tight deadline, gave them a stature in the culture. But meanwhile, they were telling the stories of ordinary people, of people who didn't have anyone speaking for them. So one of the stories in our film is about a Latina police officer who is fired from New York Police Department because she had posed for pictures in a girly magazine before she joined the force. And, you know, she's put through hell and the tabloids just go crazy on the story. And one person defends her. It's Jimmy Breslin. And he writes columns and she eventually is reinstated. Or five black teenagers are arrested in Central Park for raping a jogger. And Donald Trump, 30 years ago, says that they should be executed before they're even indicted. Central Park 5, they were called. And Pete Hamill writes a column calling him out as an awful person. And so you see that, you know, a long time before a lot of other people thought that he was a menace, the subjects of our movie understood this. After the Central Park 5 served time in prison for supposedly raping the jogger, and Trump thought they should be executed, they were exonerated by DNA evidence. They weren't even guilty. So a city, a country needs these kinds of crusading columnists who bring great reporting and great storytelling and great writing together. It's sad for the culture that they're moving off stage. The good news is there's a lot of talented young journalists who are coming up. We just have to find out what is the model, the business model that will allow them to use their talent.
Breslin and Hamill, deadline artists. Obviously, you're passionate about it. Give us just sort of an overview of what to expect when we watch this.
Well, I mean, we go through some of the stories that I talked about that show them speaking truth to power, and we explain the way they operated when they were at the peak of their powers. There's a lot of humor in the film, but also it's tragic as life takes a very tragic turn. So there's a poignancy to the film. It's really a film that's about not just Jimmy Breslin and Pete Hamill, but race and class in New York, about journalism and what's in store for print journalism and the business as a whole. And it's about a half century of American history, because they were like Selig or Forrest Gump. They were everywhere. Both of them were just inches from Robert Kennedy when he was assassinated. Jimmy witnessed Malcolm X's assassination. They were at Selma. They were with Dr. King. They were in Vietnam. So you get a sense of all the amazing stories they covered.
All right, that is director Jonathan Alter. He directed the new HBO documentary Breslin and Hamill, Deadline Artists. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batty, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
The VOA's International Edition continues. He's not a household name, but moviegoers have seen Patrick Kilpatrick in scores of action movies as a police detective or a bad guy. Mike O'Sullivan spoke with Kilpatrick about his 35 years in Hollywood as a character actor.
Hollywood, a dream for many. But for actor Patrick Kilpatrick, it's not about the glamour. It's a way to make a living.
It's like you're a gambler. You're kind of waiting for this golden hit to get the ring. And a couple of times I've had what I call Hollywood moments where, like Under Siege 2 with Steven Seagal, I was going through a divorce at the time and I was relatively down and out. I think I was down to $50. So my agent called and said, they want to hire you for this Under Siege 2 in Colorado.
And this offer of a role in the Rocky Mountain thriller put Kilpatrick back in the game. He has played opposite Jean-Claude Van Damme, Chow Yun-Fat, and nearly every action star as army privates and generals.
Or the senator, or whatever it is from starting out as the beat cop.
Kilpatrick is also a writer and has chronicled his life in Hollywood in a book. He says at times his writing skills have allowed him to expand his characters.
And then any actor who starts out is going to be in some pretty not so great films. They're not going to be the pinnacle of cinematic art. So it's really good to be able to write your own lines and create your own stuff. A lot of times I've been hired as a thug, but they get a criminal mastermind.
At 69, Kilpatrick consults with young filmmakers and continues to act, but says that will end one day.
The business uses you until you're done. So you better be prepared for that. And that can be pretty abysmal in a pretty dark place if your whole being is based on acting or writing or whatever it is, because it's going to end.
But along the way, he says it's been quite a ride. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Hollywood.
Look at me. Positive for Howard Marks. I'm placing you under arrest for the future murder of Sarah.
And finally, on this day in music history, March 11th, 1993, Eric Clapton's album Unplugged officially hit the six-month mark for being in the top 10. The album includes a version of the successful 1991 single Tears in Heaven. Its lyrics were inspired by the death of Clapton's four-year-old son, Connor. It won two Grammy Awards in 1993 and became the best-selling live album of all time, selling 26 million copies worldwide. And carry on, 'cause I know I don't belong here in heaven. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Time can break your heart.
This is VOA News. I'm Tom.